And this is Paul Rodel one more time, and IBS Oral History Project. Today, we just looked it up, is July 8th, and I'm here in Washington, D.C., in the IBS office, and I've been joined by Robert S. Ziegler. Do you prefer Bob?
Yeah, well, in conversation, sure.
Okay. Who served in Laos fairly early in the IBS experience, 1961 through 62, no, excuse, through 63. And we're going to chat today. To some extent, we're going to make up a little bit for the yellow sheet. So kind of pay attention to some of those questions and branch off onto our own. But as I said before I started the tape, we'll start off with the easy one, the easy background.
Right.
And for the sake of the tape, even though I told you beforehand, I'll just repeat the question again. And that's basically about what made Bob Ziegler join IVS when he did. So that includes things like when and where born, and something about your parents, your own social economic circumstances, religious, educational, etc., etc., what made you, at that point in time in 1961, decide to join the IBS as an organization. And now I get to sit back and listen to you talk, with hopefully a minimum of interruptions, so that I don't have to get bothered, and I'll just relax.
Okay, so here we go.
Put my feet up.
Number one is that I was born in 1920 in Elgin, Illinois.
Oh.
And my parents came originally from the East Coast, in a sense. My father came from Broadway, Virginia. My mother came from a place called Smokehole, West Virginia. They met at Bridgewater College. And then my dad got involved in Church of the Brethren denominational activities. And that's when he moved to Elgin.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, I was born then in Elgin in 1920.
Is Elgin a kind of center for the...
Yeah, it's a center for the Church of the Brethren. At that time, it still is, as in this state.
Because I was born in Chicago and grew up in Grays Lake, north of... Anyway, I'm sorry. This is not my story. It's your story.
But anyway, the important thing is that I was born into a Church of the Brethren family. And my father was what you might call a careerist or a professional in church administration.
Oh, okay.
Of the Church of the Brethren. And his original affiliations were with what was called the Home Mission Board in those days, before World War II. That was the problems of individual congregations and ministers, the assignment of ministers to different congregations, the visitation to congregations, and things like that. And, of course, I and my mother, and I had a sister who came along, we lived in Elgin, and up until the time then I graduated from high school there, went to Manchester College, which is a Church of the Brethren school.
Yeah, right.
And, somewhere along the line then, this gets me graduated in 1942, which of course relates to World War II.
Yeah.
And I had filed for a conscientious objector status, which I eventually got. And in 1943 then, I got my call, and I went to Kane, Pennsylvania, which was a CPS camp, Civilian Public Service Conscientious Objector Camp.
I didn't know that they had this thing.
Oh, yeah. And
was your CO status automatic because of Brethren, or
no? What you had to do is you had to file a claim or a description of your point of view, or a statement, I guess is a better
kind of like
word.
Write out a little essay,
yeah.
Or something.
And then you had to be interviewed and be determined to be sincere. And so obviously, if you have a congregation or denomination rather that has this as part of their belief and activities and so on and so forth, it's easier than if you were, say, an atheist in the middle of Texas. At that point, you see, being untrue or unpatriotic is a question.
Sure.
So, but if you were in one of the so-called brethren communities which existed,
mm-hmm.
why, then it would be easier for you to get what is known as a 4E classification.
Yeah.
That is an action classification similar to 1A. And when a guy got a 1A in World War II, that meant he was called up for military service.
But you were called up for this other thing.
Yeah.
And that got you...
As far as the draft board is concerned, well, I was part of the quota. And, of course, they have a quota each month or whatever it was.
Mm-hmm.
And so anyway, I went to this old CCC camp. Now, mm-hmm. I guess you know about CCC mm-hmm. camps. And this was in the forest,
mm-hmm.
Kane National Forest. And there what we did was we essentially took care of a forest. We cut down diseased and crooked and poor trees, and we planted trees, and we fought forest fires if it was necessary.
Yeah.
Things like that there.
Yeah.
And then, but that part of the program, for your information, was financed essentially by members of the denominations who were supporting the CPS program.
Mm-hmm.
So that meant somebody back somewhere was putting up the money to pay for your food and stuff like that.
Yeah, yeah.
So then a thing called detached service developed, which meant then you could be transferred to something else, which some people thought was perhaps even more significant, like work in mental hospitals was an easy example.
Yeah.
And then they had guys who were smoke jumpers. They would go out and fly over forest fires mm-hmm. out in the west and drop down in a parachute and that kind of thing.
Trying to get the middle of them and put them out.
And then there were different kinds of medical experimental ones. The most famous was a starvation unit in Minneapolis, Minnesota, where they intentionally starved guys down to a certain weight and then intentionally brought them back up to determine, you know, the psychological, physiological aspects of this, which would be hopefully useful in the future.
I'd never want to do that.
Yeah. Well, anyway, that's story there. But we're talking about the detached service concept. And
mm-hmm.
of course,
I
was in a veterans mental hospital then. And you see, what you're going to get from me is a kind of a continuum of what you might say service type activities.
Which would not necessarily be out of the norm.
Yeah. So anyway, having done that, so then when I got discharged, I ended up down at New Windsor, Maryland. Now, you know about New Windsor, Maryland? There's a famous service center, relief center. It was purchased. It was an old college which was purchased by the Church of the Brethren
mm-hmm.
as an empty set of buildings. It closed during the war, or at the early part of the war. And so here you had all these buildings which were usable. And then, after the church purchased it, well, then a number of CPS guys from different places went down there and put it in shape,
mm-hmm.
paint and renovate and things like that there. And so then this place began to receive contributed food and clothes and things like that for shipment and medicines for
uh-huh.
shipment overseas in those days, essentially to Europe after World War II.
Right.
And then they also had offices there for refugees and exchange programs and Heifer Project.
And you did this even though your obligations were already taken
care of. Well, of course, at that
of.
Point you got a minimal salary. You
mm-hmm.
lived there. I think we got base rate or something like that, but that was acceptable because mm-hmm. you were, in a sense, you had a sense of compensation or duty or perhaps... not necessarily guilt, but obviously you had an easier life than some guy who was in the line of fire in combat.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as you and I know, not everybody was in the line of fire either.
Well, no, there's a lot of people in supply and
that's true.
KP and stuff.
Agreed. Anyway, so I went down there, and I don't know if you ever heard, now some of the fellows you're going to run into maybe were what were known as seagoing cowboys, and after the war, then Church of the Brethren people related to what was then called the Brethren Service Committee. That's the entity that's related to IVS, Brethren
mm-hmm.
Service Committee. They came down to the UNRWA headquarters and whoever it was and said, what are you going to do about livestock?
Uh-huh.
Up till that time, they hadn't thought about livestock. And so all of a sudden, then, a major program developed in the shipping, particularly horses and mules for power. to Europe. And this went all the way across to Poland. And then they also would ship contributed heifers. Now, you know what a heifer is, I guess.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Contributed heifers, that was the beginning of what was known as the Heifer Project Program, or the second phase. The first shipment went to Puerto Rico during World War II, because they were contributed to Brethren's Service, Heifer Project, but of course they grew up and got pregnant, so they had to go somewhere, and that's where they went.
Mm-hmm.
So then they began to ship cattle and horses, of course, under the UNRWA program, cattle under the Heifer Project,
mm-hmm.
on ships, and they needed guys to take care of them, so they called them seagoing cowboys. All right, so you have to recruit, and I was in the recruitment activity,
uh-huh.
and as I remember, we recruited somewhere between 4,000 and 5,000 guys to make these trips, and it's very like, since it was post-war, it's very likely that some ex-CPSers, well, I know ex-CPSers did, and maybe then some IVSers did also. I have to find out about that.
Yeah.
Anyway, so they went. Well, I worked at that for a while, then I went to New York and worked at Church World Service up there,
mm-hmm.
and for a while, then I got off the track a little bit and did some other things because I thought I wanted to go into city management as a profession, and then changed my mind, and I quit my job with Church World Service. So on, but then eventually I joined up with Heifer Project,
uh-huh.
in about 52, I think it was, and went back to New Windsor. And at that time, then we had the Heifer Project office there. The headquarters were in North Manchester, Indiana, and they had two people in California and one in Oregon. So that was the nucleus staff.
Uh-huh.
Used a lot of volunteer people. So anyway, I worked at Heifer Project for a while, and then one day, about after I'd been there for 9 or 10 years, something like that, 9 years, I guess, Harold Rao, then executive secretary, executive director of the Brethren Service Committee, said one time in an annual meeting or something like that, in a casual situation, said, if you're going to work on this overseas business, you ought to have an overseas tour. You ought to know what it's like over there. Well, that sounded reasonable.
Fair enough, yeah.
And, of course, I had 9 years in with Heifer Project by that time, and had traveled quite a bit, no question about that, but never sat in one place.
Right.
So I knew that IVS was looking for somebody to head up what was called the Rural Development Team in Laos. Now, in those days, there were brethren scattered all over in these non-governmental organizations,
uh-huh.
like CROP, like CARE, like Heifer Project, like, let's see, IVS,
mm-hmm.
John Knopfinger, a name that you may know. He's a Brethren
yeah.
guy, too, at that time. Well, I knew it was open, so I just got on the phone and called him.
Said, hey.
Of course, he knew who I was,
mm-hmm.
so filled out the form. And I think it was sometime in 1960. Well, it seemed like a major jump, so I resigned from Heifer Project, thinking that I would go at a moment's notice, and it didn't happen. And so I had about a year of waiting.
Oh, gee.
And part of that time I didn't spend down here in Washington.
Mm-hmm.
And I was in Washington then at the time of the Kennedy inauguration and the day soon after that, because I went out to, as I remembered, I went out to Laos in, I think, I can't remember right now, March, April, somewhere along
okay.
there. And
first quarter sometime.
Yeah. But during that time in Washington, in the office,
mm-hmm.
a lot of people from then, the new Peace Corps under the Kennedy administration, would come out to IVS and talk to Dr. Knopfinger about what IVS did on insurance or the selection process or different categories of
mm-hmm.
insurance. Of course, he had a little bit of experience by that time.
Oh, yeah, yeah. How long had he already been executive director?
Frankly, I don't know.
Okay.
But anyway, he did.
I hear his name a lot.
Yeah.
It would be wonderful if he could be met, but...
Yeah, well, if you want to meet him.
Yeah, I think...
Not if you're coming back.
Yeah, I don't think I'll postpone that
yeah.
that interview until
right.
until the last minute.
But anyway, so I was there, and then I went out to Laos.
Yeah,
Head of the rural development team of IVS.
Yeah, but Nofsinger, though, what was he like? Because I hear his name a lot, and you actually know him, and other people who I've heard about him only were volunteers who spent like a week in Washington before they were sent off somewhere.
Yeah.
And obviously, you've got more you could say about the man, and I'd really be interested.
Yeah.
Well, this is even from a personal standpoint. You know.
Well, anyway, number one is he graduated from a school called Mount Morris, which was a church school in Illinois.
Okay.
And then it closed, and then it affiliated itself in some kind of a method with Manchester College, so all the records and everything are at Manchester College for
him. That's how I've heard of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
All right. Now, he was an educator, school teacher, and one of the, he was a kind of a predecessor of IVS, because somewhere along the line, and I forget whose presidential administration it was, but he went to the Philippines as a school teacher.
Oh.
And so he taught in the Philippine school systems in some of those villages, and one of the stories I now remember was that a Filipino friend came to him. There was a anti-American movement in the Philippines that existed to some extent, and so one friend came to him and said, "You better get out of town because the bad boys are coming." And so it was a full moon, as I remember. And so they didn't want to do their action during the full moon time, which enabled him to leave and hopefully then survive. And then, of course...
How old do you think he was when he died?
Oh, shoot, he was 65, 75, something like that.
And when did he die?
Oh, I would say, let's see, where? 60, sometime between 70 and 75, I think.
So he was born around 1900.
I would think so.
Okay, I'm trying to figure out how old he would have been when he was in the Philippines.
Yeah, well, these are things we can work on.
Okay, but,
anyway.
So he wasn't in the original group of American teachers that went over. He probably went over around the 20s or 30s.
Well, I don't know when the originals went.
Oh, they went almost as soon as we took it over as a colony.
Well, there's something to find out.
Yeah.
Number two, however, was then he came back, and in some way or other he ended up with a doctorate. And part of the time he worked with the Carnegie Institute for Education, or whatever that agency is right now.
Yeah.
And then he worked there until he essentially retired. And so the IVS was a so-called post-retirement job. And then after he put in some years at IVS and finished, and I don't know why it was, then he went over to Peace Corps and put in two or three, 4 years over there as a senior citizen type guy.
Yeah.
So anyway, that's something about him.
Yeah, and he was the one that people setting up Peace Corps were consulting about.
That's right. Now, of course, IVS, you see, it already had teams in Iraq.
Absolutely.
And it already had teams in Cambodia, Laos, and Vietnam, too, by the time he came on board.
Right, yeah,
and so,
sure.
Anyway, that's, so he had a, what you might say, a body of reference.
Sure, some good experiences, at least what not to do, and if not, what to do. Okay.
So anyway, that's the way that worked. Now then, so that's the, I would say, the, and another interesting thing about him to me as an administrator, at least as a supervisor, was many times, or a number of times with me, he'd come up and there would be some kind of an issue, and he'd cite a biblical reference. You know, like, I forgot who it was, took his troops down to the creek, and before they went off to attack the Gideonites or the Midianites or somebody, and some of them stuck their face right in the water, well, he eliminated them. And then others swooped it up in their mouth, he eliminated them. And others, in there, like that, looked around. Those are the ones he wanted to keep. So then he went off and won the battle with them. All right, so he'd tell you a story like that. We'd be talking about a problem. He said, "You know, I'm reminded of Joshua, and he'd cite a story. And then you'd hear the story. Well, you learn after a while that the answer is in the story. He didn't tell you to go
circle the whatever it is, he told you to think about it. And then you found out, oh, Joshua, he went around three times. Okay, well, I'll go around three times too, and whatever it is.
Yeah, yeah.
So that was an interesting methodology of guidance or direction from him.
Anyway. Good teaching tool.
Yeah. So that's that bit. That's all I can think of. Oh, he had a, I don't know if you're trying to accumulate information on him, but he had a daughter who was quite a French speaker. She was on a faculty at one of the schools in Montreal. And she married a man up there, and I don't know anything about her right now. But she was good enough to be a French teacher in Montreal. That tells you something.
Yeah, that certainly does tell you that. No, I was just curious about him a little bit because I had heard the name. But I didn't want to, you know, hold back your story too much. You know,
you got it on the tape.
Yeah, that's fine. But anyway, so you
now you see
you waited. Yeah, you waited for basically almost a year.
Oh yeah, but I had a satisfactory life while I was doing it. Actually, at that time, I was up in Pendle Hill. Have you ever heard of Pendle Hill?
Mm-mm, no.
Well, Heifer Project moved up to an office up to Upper Darby, Pennsylvania. It's a suburb of
Philadelphia. Yeah.
And I and two other colleagues then stayed in Pendle Hill, which is a Quaker retreat area, which was only about 10 miles or so away. And then, of course, when I resigned from Heifer Project, why then I hung around in different places in the Eastern Seaboard with friends and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
And then part of the time was in Washington here.
Yeah, yeah. Helping out in the IVS office.
Yeah, and I didn't get paid or anything like that, but I survived, you know.
Well, yeah,
in those days, it didn't seem like it was a problem.
Mm-hmm.
All right, now, at this point now, I've landed in Laos. Now what do you want me to tell you?
Well, first of all, though, how did they choose Laos for you?
They didn't.
You
remember, I knew that they were looking for a leader for the rural development team, which had not been fielded.
Okay, so you volunteered for that position because you heard about that particular slot. Okay.
Also, as a head of the team, you weren't exactly a typical volunteer.
Right.
You got, I think it was, I remember, $2,000 a year.
It's pretty good money for there. And then?
And of course, it was all government money. You know, this was provided by the contract.
Yeah.
Oh, well, of course, as you know, then the IVS activity in Southeast Asia was on government contracts. Okay. So administration and everything. Was
USOM and then AID later.
Yeah. The contract actually came out of Washington, but that doesn't make any difference.
Right, yeah. Right, yeah.
So that's, so I wasn't selected, I applied and was approved, you might say.
Yeah, okay. So one of the questions that I've asked people, and it's kind of interesting some of the answers I got, was what was your first impression when you arrived?
Well, number one is, of course, I'd never been in Southeast Asia. I had been as far east or west, or whatever you want to call it, whatever, as Afghanistan. So I'd knocked
pretty
around.
Pretty far.
Yeah. You know, some. So I knew about what you might call, what some people would call poverty and so on. And that was in my Heifer Project times.
Right.
And so I had to fly out, and as I remember, the flight was Hawaii. And Tokyo, Hong Kong, Bangkok.
Mm-hmm.
At that point, I got off the plane. I think I may have stopped over in Tokyo, and then went up to with a different plane to passenger plane to Vientiane, Laos. All right. And in those days, I was met by a U.S. government guy, because there weren't any IVSers to meet me. And as I remember, we stopped and looked at a two-engine airplane that had just landed in the two-seater.
Mm-hmm.
And the pilot pointed out the seat next to him, and they had a bullet hole right in the middle of it. And somebody had been down underneath and took a shot at it. And so anybody had been sitting there would have had something to contend with, of course.
Mm-hmm.
So that was kind of an opener. And then, of course, once again, as you know, when you're overseas in a U.S. government mission, you're in a kind of a little America. So it isn't quite as stressful, for some people anyway, as it might be if you just had to go down and move into a village without any kind of help, assistance, or guidance or direction. So they had a housing facility, you know, like a place for where we could stay, and where I could stay, and had a restaurant where I could eat, and had an office where I could sit, and, you know, things like that there. So it was a reasonable way to begin. The buildings looked like old military barracks, if you know what those look like. They were off the ground, so if the air could go underneath, that was good, of course.
Yeah.
And so that's, so from the point of view of a great culture shock, I don't think I really had a, me, I don't think I had a great culture shock.
Yeah.
You know, I had some, I guess the, you always have the start-up problems, because for me, I got there and I was here supposed to be head of this team. Well, number one is we didn't have any people selected. There was one person who was there who was the carryover from the famous Xinguang team, which was up north, IBS.
Is that where they had the Brahma Bulls?
Well, poof. Frankly, I don't know about that right now. I can't answer you.
Except that
was Xinguang, and of course, by the time I got there, Xinguang was under the control of the enemy, who might that may be. But there was this woman, Esther Camphausen, who had been part of it. She was a nurse, and I don't know where she is now.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, she was waiting around to complete her tour of duty, which was a two-year tour in those days for her. And so she was there. But so I spent some months while IBS was beginning to submit candidacies of people. Of course, they had to come out. There was a joint approval between the so-called me, the IBS field rep, and also the AID person, who was a contract representative, liaison officer. So it took some time. So actually, then I imagine I had 3 or 4 months of singularity, you might say, with Esther. She was working around in some public type health projects, something like that.
Uh-huh.
That's about the way it was. Then eventually the people begin to come out, and then you begin to do things in different ways. Now then, the general idea of the AID Rural Development Program was this. Since progress has not been taking place in any village, because there's no reason for it to change, there are no materials, there is no stimulation for it to change, why it goes along as normal or traditional. And the idea was that in some way or other, the American presence, in cooperation with the Lao government, would meet with a village council and say, we can provide you materials which relate to either, say, building a school, or building a bridge, or building a dam, or a garden project, or something like that. But these are things that the people in that community weren't able to get. That's why they didn't have them. And that's why they didn't have a local school, or they didn't do this or do that. And so what this invitation did, or identification of resources was, it meant that they had to think about what do we want to do, and what do we want to do most and when. And that's all good for the development of a group of people. And then after that, they had to submit a request through channels, through their government, which strengthens their government. At that point, you had what you might call the governor of the province or the governor of the state, who would get the request, and he would consider it and process it and forward it on to headquarters, the government, the Lao government headquarters, which then had in its resources or available, say, nails or seeds or cement or roofing sheets and things like that there, the physical resources and some money. But most of it was all physical, and so it was a self-help type project, and also technical assistance would be provided, like if you're going to build a dam or build a bridge or build a school and things like that, and some people could go out and give advice and help. Okay, but the point was is that these people had different resources presented to them for possible use. Then they had to decide what they wanted to do, and then they had to take the appropriate action, which puts them into part of being a part of the government. And the government would respond, so that's appealing, of course. Well, now then we go back to the idea of IBS. And of course, you know about Dale Clark, I guess. You know about Dale Clark?
But okay. It's good to go over a little bit.
Well, Dale Clark, of course, was the original idea man for IBS, and he was a Mormon, as you may know. And anyway, his idea was, as an aid employee, when anyway, back to Dale Clark.
But Dale Clark, he was...
He worked for AID.
That's right. He was an AID fellow, you know, in deciding that we got to get people down on the ground in Laos, but I didn't know that he was a Mormon.
Yes, well, he is. And he's alive.
Oh, really? Where is he now?
Well, he's out in Idaho right now someplace, I think.
Oh.
But he's findable.
Yeah.
So anyway...
I might write his name down. It might be a good idea just to try to...
D-A-L-E Clark.
Mm-hmm.
And I've got his children's name and phone number, which I can give to you. They're in nearby Virginia.
Okay.
So anyway, that's that story. Well, anyway, his idea. Well, the Mormons weren't themselves interested.
Right, no, they don't really do that kind of stuff.
But then he learned about, in some way or other, about the Brethren and the Mennonites and the Quakers.
Mm-hmm.
The Quakers weren't interested because they, well, they weren't, I can't tell you why. But the Brethren, under this guy, Harold Rao, who would told me that if I was going to do something,
you ought to go out there.
Try it.
Yeah.
And a man named William Snyder, who was then with the head of the Mennonite Central Committee.
Okay.
Up in Akron, Pennsylvania.
Uh-huh.
So they created IVS. And that was the entity that contracted with AID.
Uh-huh.
So it was neither Brethren nor it was neither Mennonite. Yeah.
But weren't the Quakers in on the original?
No, negative.
Really? I thought it was all three.
I don't think so.
Oh, okay. All right.
And I've never seen any evidence. They might have started out and backed out. That could be in some of the pre-planning days.
Okay, that's possible. Or maybe they might have come in some other later point in time.
No.
No, okay. All right.
So anyway... I don't remember where I got lost in this fog right now, but anyway, we're talking about being out there. Oh, then what the Dale Clark idea was to have people on site. So
exactly.
We're talking about the rural development crowd now. So
sure.
AID then had a lot of people that were based in Bench on Laos headquarters, and then they had the different provincial headquarters,
Savannah
State headquarters. And then the idea was to have people who would get out and work with the people.
Uh-huh.
And it's understandable. A highly skilled and experienced technician is an agronomist or something like that, spending time with the native personnel at the production level, at the lowest level, might not be an efficient way to use him.
Not really.
He can advise, the appropriate people like IVSers and their counterparts on how to work with the T department and
or run a research station or something like that.
So anyway, that's what these, then they were scattered out, and the IVS were scattered out either by themselves or in these provincial capitals, and then they would go out. Okay. Now, then the way they functioned is they knew what they could do, but they actually had to be pretty individual and self-reliant. And that's where I, myself, as an administrator now, kind of feel like maybe I didn't do it right, in simple English, because these guys were coming all out in the 60s, and I got the impression that they wanted to do it their way, and they could do it their way, and independence and self-reliance were part of it. And so my administrative style then was one of, what you might say, provided independence. And then if they wanted to do something, then they'd have to come back. And I had, in a way, I had a reference there, and that was the style of the Xinguang team, which on its own developed itself and learned how to get along and all that other kind of stuff. And that's the way I kind of ran it. And then if these guys needed help, well, then they'd have to take initiatives. In other words, they were growing up too, you might say, to become part of an institution and its program and stuff like that there. Of course, we had an eye on them in different ways. They were visited an awful lot in different ways by AID technicians. Then it even got up to higher level people like ambassadors and head of USIA or the aid mission director. One of the interesting paradoxes is that the ambassador would go out someplace, for example, and stay a week or two, a day or two or three with a guy, and then he would say, well, when you come to Vientiane, come see me. I'd like to talk to you. And so this guy gets off the plane, and he goes to see the ambassador. And that's something that, you see, the majority of AID, state, and USIA people could not do at all without an appointment. His naivete and belief was, the ambassador said, come see me.
So he did.
Which made a lot of people squirm, you might say, because of this kind of access. Well, it's understandable on the part of everybody why they squirmed and why he did it and why the ambassador did it, too. You know?
Well, you mean to say that the ambassador was really genuine?
Sure.
Okay. I wasn't sure if it was just like, come and see me sometime, but didn't really mean it.
Well, I do. I mean, knowing the ones that that I remember.
Okay. Yeah.
And so that was a kind of a human relations aspect of the thing. Well, anyway, these fellows were out there in these different posts.
How many did you get?
Oh, I think the max was about 30. So.
30? That's a pretty big program.
Well, in a way, yeah. And then another thing, too, then I also started was training of Laotians. And so this included an office staff as well as a field staff. And the field staff, so the office staff, well, with them, I...
These were Lao.
Yeah. And then in my ignorance, you never know who's a Lao and who isn't a Lao. You know, when did you come across the Mekong River last or something like that? But anyway, I trained an office staff, which included a couple secretaries, one of which came, and I taught shorthand. I knew shorthand and typing and all that kind of office skills stuff. So she became good enough that she even worked here in the IVS office in the United States for a while. And she's still in the United States working on another task.
But, who's this?
Betsong is her name. And anyway,
she's around. Wow, would it be possible to find her?
Well, I got some phone numbers.
Because if possible, it'd be kind of fun to talk to her and get her impressions too.
Well, anyway,
I'll write her name down. Petsong?
Phetsong. They may even have it right here.
Never know.
Yeah, that's right.
You might be a lot better than a source than
she's
here.
She's got a second name too, and right now I don't remember what it is. But anyway, and also then, we got people, we found, or I believe anyway, at that time, the best people that we could get were people who had failed the baccalaureate exam. Are you familiar with the baccalaureate level exam? Well, anyway, that's the highest level before university. And so, or college, university.
This is in Laos?
No, this is in the French educational system.
Ah, all right, okay. This system I don't know.
Yeah, and it's somewhere, actually it's supposed to be somewhere into the freshman year of college.
Okay,
And
people who failed that?
Yeah, that's what I wanted. Why? Because if they passed the baccalaureate, well then they'd be trying to get a scholarship to go on the normal route, whatever that was, which hopefully was France. And so on. But if they failed it, well then that wasn't available to them. So here we have a new choice, a new opportunity. In fact, that's true, I think. I don't know what your experience has been with, or what you hear, but for foreigners to come any place to try to get people to work with them, at least at some times, the oddball, the dissident, the unsatisfied, the dissatisfied, the outcast, are the easiest ones to find to come work for these uncertain people, because
makes sense.
Sure. Well, anyway, this has got nothing to do with character right now, or personality. It has to do with just educational achievement.
Absolutely.
And why did they fail? Well, who knows? You know, they could have had a headache.
That's right.
And then, if you know anything about the French testing system, well, that in itself is a threatening process.
I know a little bit about some of the testing. It's intended to have people fail.
Right. Anyway, so that was the kind of people we had. So we had an office group.
Who could be some very good people.
Sure. And which included then an accountant type guy and a couple of secretary, a couple of clerk typists. And then I moved on to what you might call field assistants. These would be people who would work with the American IBS out at a field site. So the subjects then had to do with some translation and some interpreting, and improving your English, of course. And we had typewriters. We taught them some typing. And then there's a fellow came out named Joe Flipsy, who was a mechanic, and he taught them automobile mechanics, driving. And we got them driver's licenses, so on and so forth, so they could be a counterpart or a colleague. I forgot our exact term right now.
I think a lot of people say counterpart.
Well, we didn't use it then, though.
Oh, you didn't? Okay.
Because a counterpart was a little bit higher level.
Oh, yeah. It's usually also, I think, it's been associated with government folks.
Anyway.
Yeah.
Now, with me then, my associations were with a member of the Rural Development Team, an AID. He would be the contract representative. And then also people in the Rural Development Division of Laos. And then when you go out to post, to where a guy was, he would be your man in the field, and he would introduce you to the governor or to whomever, or the chief of the village or whatever it was, that kind of thing. And sometimes he would initiate projects too. That would be outside of the regular rural development project process that I described to you earlier on. So that's the way that worked.
But they could be incorporated.
Oh, yeah, sure, yeah. And so anyway, that's the way that worked. Now then, the problem, there were a couple of problems, as I see it now, is that we didn't do a good job on language training. We could have, you see, a guy shows up at Vientiane, and his assignment post is Paxe, which is 100 and some miles away. Well, how soon do you want to get him on post? And the longer he spends in Vientiane, the more he may want to stay in Vientiane, i.e. Paris, or he may get itchy and want to get out of Vientiane and never come back again. And that was the kind of philosophy that I was inclined to use, is not having Vinchon too enjoyable a life. And so then hopefully then they would go down to Foxe. And we had some team chiefs at each, in some of those places. One we had down there, a guy named Carter, had a PhD, and so on and so forth, in economics. And they could start their own individual activities down there, like language study and so on and so forth. And that's the way I thought it should be. And, but obviously you have different levels of achievement then. But if you would have kept them in Vinchon for X numbers of months until they achieved an adequate level of language study, studying 6 hours a day, which is what you have with four or five anyway, which is the Foreign Service Institute.
Right.
Why, then all of a sudden they learn how to speak Lao very well in Vinchon, but why go to Pakse to speak Lao? I can do it here, and life here is pretty good.
Well, you kick them out.
Yeah. Well, anyway, anyway, we're talking about some of the aspects of the thing.
Uh-huh.
Now, when it came to, I don't know what you want to know, but we're talking about methods of operation. Now, we had a commissary in Vinchon, which had to do with American food, imported food. And these guys had access to that. And they could call in orders, send in orders.
This was for IVS, or was this part of the U.S. Mission?
The commissary was for all eligible Americans.
Okay, so it was probably a State Department kind of
run thing?
Yeah,
it was
thing?
Under the...
Okay.
Uh-huh. And so, but IVS were eligible.
Oh,
they were
okay.
Contractors,
yeah.
By definition.
Okay.
And once again, you remember when you, that's something else again, when you have a person working for you, you want him to be as successful as possible.
Yeah.
And if he's going to get sick because he doesn't have good food and could have good food, well then, is this a good idea? And I'll give you an easy example. And at one time, some people thought it was smart to go down and wash clothes in the river with the native women to show how egalitarian they were, or equal. And somewhere along the line, they got the idea that the Laotian people thought, well, what kind of experts are these? They come out here and they have to wash their own clothes. You know?
Yeah. Yeah, I understand.
And, so that's we're talking about a local attitude and mm-hmm. too much involvement with local conditions, cultural and personal human
mm-hmm.
activities.
Mm-hmm.
So you remember, your idea is to get them to function as well as possible. And so we did then have a process of supplying food, if necessary, from Vinchon when recorded. Now, most of what would happen is that a lot of these so-called teams of two or three people, four people, they would hire a cook who would get stuff locally, and that's all right.
Probably be fresher and better tasting.
Not unlikely. Yeah, mm-hmm. Except that if you did want a can of sardines one time, why, you could get it, you know, from headquarters.
I can't stand
you sardines.
Like sardines.
Well, anyway, it eliminates that. But anyway, we're talking about food.
Yeah.
And of course, then we also had a medical facility there,
mm-hmm.
and so they were
oh, that's
eligible
important.
For that. And so that's the food, clothing, and shelter. And of course, the housing was something that the team chief would find, or aide might have a house available that they had rented in some fashion that we could move into. So that's the way it worked.
You didn't think of families?
Ah. At that time, I think it was, I think for a while, that they didn't even want married people in the early days because of the conflicts of interest. You're familiar with the problem of having two people who are a team who may represent a point of view which may not, which could be unbalancing in some way, the general group feeling and attitude, something like that.
That's a
at one time,
possibility, but it's not.
At one time, it used to even
not a reality.
Yeah, it's a well, it's, it all depends on whether it becomes a reality.
Becomes or not,
yeah.
It can be, but you don't have to be married.
No, agreed. No, and
But I think it was a kind of a Knopfinger idea at that time to simplify and reduce the number of problems. Like I remember in the application form that we sent out, I think we sent out to 5 different people for references. From 5 people?
From 5 people.
And he said if we got 1 red flag, throw him out. Hmm. 1 red flag. Wow. Yeah. So, be that as it may, we're talking about the reduction of problems.
Well, I wasn't, when I said families, I didn't mean the volunteers as families, but I was thinking about the housing. You wouldn't put them up with Lao families?
Ah.
For a host family? How come?
Well, I think that it was considered to be inefficient. Inefficient.
Really?
Yeah, even the Peace Corps doesn't live with people.
Oh, yeah, we sure did.
In their same houses?
Oh, yeah.
Were you a Peace Corps guy?
I sure was.
Where?
Philippines.
Okay. Well, anyway, they didn't do it.
I've always wondered why. Because I've had all these people say that they live with other Americans, and it seemed to me to be so inefficient, actually.
Well, I don't know what to tell you right now.
Okay.
I mean, I can surmise just as well as you could, but I think that the tradition, the custom had been set, more or less, for the Americans to live in their own houses. Now, of course, you're familiar with the economic impact of foreigners on a local market, I guess, where if you have the foreigners coming down and buying up stuff that could either take it off the market for others or drive up the prices for the local people. That's happened in some places in the world, though I'm not sure how many people it would take to do it. But a lot of times the local markets are just, their maintenance level situations.
One mouse doesn't make that much difference, I don't think.
Not one. No.
No.
But anyway. So that's we're in speculation. And so there's nothing to worry about that right now. But that's the way it was. They all had places. And it may be, well, anyway. So we got food, we got the housing business, and then when it came to transportation, old Joe Flipsy, the U.S. Army, had essentially abandoned about 8 or 10 Jeeps when they left Laos. And old Joe got a hold of them, and with his squad of mechanic trainees, field assistant trainees. Why, they rehabbed them all, or most of them. They took some parts out of this one, parts out of that one,
sure,
built again, and then they drove them out. And so that's what we had to drive around in for a while until we got better vehicles. And you see, you always have a problem of maintenance. I don't know what you did, but if you need vehicles for, then you have to order them. Well, then it's a year or two from the order time until you get them. So that was, again, a startup problem. And at one time, our only transportation, as far as wheels was concerned, was a one of these old flatbed trucks that we posted. We had some side racks on, and we'd drive around on that.
And, this would be pretty good.
Oh, yeah, but you couldn't go all over the country in it. That was just...
No, it's too big.
Yeah. Well, and of course, you couldn't get down there because of the insecurity of things. Now, when it came to personal security, first off, almost every one of these units of people had a single sideband radio, which was provided by the U.S. government. And they'd have a radio check every day. And so you knew who there was, where they were, how things were getting along. Also, if the ambassador was going to come out there, why, he would let them know, or other
people.
Or
anybody.
So that's the way that worked. We also got some motorcycles, which were pretty good, too. And we never had any accidents with our crew, anyway. And so
If it had been me, you would have had at least one accident.
I know that in the 80s, they did have Peace Corps motorcycle accidents in Africa.
Probably.
Too disastrous.
And, oh, really?
Because they weren't wearing helmets at the time.
Yeah.
But anyway, that's that part of that. And we're talking about transportation. And then you had airplanes that would fly from Vientiane to airfields nearby where these guys were located.
Mm-hmm.
And so you'd work on that as it was. And stuff would be transported to them, sometimes in airplanes, sometimes in trucks or in boats.
Uh-huh.
Depends.
It depends, yeah. So some might be along the Mekong, so.
Yeah. And so now where are we?
Well, all of these volunteers that you had, you said about 30 of them.
Mm-hmm.
What were they doing?
Well,
because you were basically in charge of supervising all of what they did, and
they
didn't all do the same kind of thing, did they?
No, it depended a little bit on their skill.
Yeah.
And they tried to fit in as well as they could with different agencies, like Esther Camphausen. She worked in a hospital and nurses training type stuff.
Okay.
And then we had an architect who worked with a Bureau of, roads or some similar type outfit.
Okay.
Where she could use her architectural skills.
All right.
Most of them were agriculturally related type guys in ag projects.
Okay.
At that point, then you see you have the
backup. What kind of ag, though?
Well, they could be, and also some basic construction, too. Oh, garden projects, for example, would be one. And usually it would be small type things. Not rice, but there was one guy that did work on a rice project where he had a significant lowland rice activity.
Oh, okay.
See, as you know, you have different kinds of rice and different kinds of rice production, and he worked in the paddy rice area as opposed to mountain rice and stuff like that. And
well, this is before the hybrid
kind
of stuff later.
Before it got started, yeah. And then we also had some guys that were involved in construction. We built earth block houses, schools.
Uh-huh.
You're familiar with earth block methodology?
Uh-huh.
And we had some of them, which we got. And so that would be, that takes some time to do, you know. One of the problems with rural development, I don't know what you did, but the problem with rural development is you go out to a village and say to the villager, we got cement, we got roofing sheets, we got nails, and we got seeds, and if you tell us what you want, then we'll help you when you get it. Well, that in itself is going to take some time.
Which particular part?
I mean the process.
Okay.
I go and talk to somebody tomorrow, and then they got to talk it over in a sufficient way.
Mm-hmm.
They have to prepare their submission, which has to go through the governor, which has to go to headquarters, and the stuff has to come back. And so, as a result, you got to have a presence in order to initiate the thing. But you can't. If we have a meeting tomorrow, there's nothing for me to do with that village on the day after or the day after that. Particularly as it relates to this project, because they've got to do it themselves.
I'm going to think about it.
Yeah, that's right.
Discuss and all that stuff.
Yeah. And so then, obviously, then you try to have a string of villages. So you're not dependent upon one.
Get a kind of cluster.
But then one of the interesting things about aid at that time, Aid Laos.
Uh-huh.
Had, I think, the second or third highest number of people in country of all aid missions.
This is of the regular aid, not your contract folks.
Yeah,
okay.
aid, and I think that would be the whole shebang. Doesn't make any difference.
All right, okay.
And Vietnam was the biggest at that time. And there may have been some other place, maybe Brazil. But it was only about, I think in the 20s, as far as the budget was concerned.
20 million?
No, in the 20th from the top.
20th, okay, in terms of ranking. Okay,
yeah.
Number 20, okay.
And you see, if you're going to have a project where you got some people that are going to use some
cement and some roofing sheets and a couple of some seeds, that may not even cost $100.
Uh-huh.
But you got to have a guy there that can activate it or utilize it. Whereas another guy can in another country will take some place where they're going to build a dam.
They can build a dam. Hundreds of millions.
Yeah. You only got a program officer, you got an engineer, and mm-hmm. you got a few other people, and you spend an incredible amount of money. So that was, but that's what we're talking about is the numbers of humans that it takes to run a rural development program, just like this country. In the old days, we had a county agent in every county. We may even uh-huh. had an assistant.
Yeah.
And then you had somebody that worked on the female side.
Yep.
And so.
And maybe a doctor.
And so this is in the United States of America. So we're mm-hmm. talking about the personnel numbers mm-hmm. for that kind of a program.
It would be very high.
That's right. So anyway, and in a way, then you don't get much done.
No.
When it's quantifiable. And that was one of the problems we had. And the rural development had, and mm-hmm. aid had, was quantifiable returns. As far as satisfying the critics, wherever they may have been. And of course, that in those days, at that time, of course, you had an incredible freedom, you might say, because this was from 61 on up through whenever they left.
Uh-huh.
I was, of course, I left in 64. I left in 63 plus. But anyway,
oh, uh-huh.
but there was a lot of money available. For all kinds of things, because the American endeavor was to be successful. And a couple of $100 or $1,000 wasn't too important, as long as it could be, you know, supported or justified. So that's the way that worked there.
But it seems like a contradiction, though.
Yeah.
A pretty bad contradiction. Did that ever hurt the program?
As far as funding is concerned, I don't think so.
Uh-huh, okay.
Because we're still worried about the deck of cards, Eisenhower's deck of cards, you might say.
What do you mean by deck of cards?
Well, if Vietnam falls, well then Laos will okay. fall, then Cambodia will fall, and then Thailand will fall.
Yeah.
That was, you know, that was a reasonable theory.
Uh-huh.
It didn't work out in a way. Mm-hmm. Fortunately, things stopped at the Thai border.
Mm-hmm.
But